Well, hello and welcome to another episode of the Capital Record Podcast, brought to you by National Review's Capital Matters. This is David Bonson. I am your host of the Capital Record, and I love introducing new topics and especially new guests to our efforts, which are, of course, the constant defense of a free and virtuous society. And today, I'm very pleased to be bringing on Lyman Stone, who some of you may know as really a quite prominent expert in the subject of demographics. He serves as the research fellow at the Institute of Family Studies. He is involved at the consulting firm Demographic Intelligence, where his data analytics are vitally useful for various corporations. He is also an adjunct fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and that's where I first got familiar with his work, and I am really looking forward to having him on. He has a significant background as an academic economist and now a sociologist, and I believe that we have spent a lot of time here at this podcast, and I intend to continue spending time looking at monetary policy, looking at fiscal policy, looking at financial markets. There's a lot of themes we care about because our focus of this podcast is the defense of capital markets. But when we look to the higher level subject of the economy, and because we view economics as something rooted in a human individual who has both individual and communal components, that they mankind is both individualistic and a social animal all at once, I don't know how you can really separate this subject from better understanding of economic growth expectations and the allocation of resources. And I think you're going to find the contribution Lyman Stone has to this subject to be vital, valuable, and provocative. So with that, let me bring on first-time guest to Capital Record, Lyman Stone. So with that said, welcome to another episode of the Capital Record, and yes, another first-time guest. So very happy to welcome Lyman Stone. Lyman, welcome to the Capital Record.
Thank you. It's really good to be with you.
So we cover a lot of economic topics here on Capital Record, but I don't think that we've delved in with any kind of fine-tuning to the subject of demographics. We've covered it peripherally. We've had a kind of dedicated social and moral aspect to the subject with my good friend, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris from the Ruth Institute. But as far as the real kind of advanced level of demographics and analysis of what that means economically and culturally, that I've been reading from you for quite some time and that I think you've sort of devoted a good portion of your study to, this is kind of new to listeners at Capital Record here at National Review. And I'm just wondering if you could maybe start by telling listeners a little bit about yourself and what your area of study is professionally.
Sure. I don't know what's best to tell you about myself. I'm kind of a boring story. I'm basically a demographic researcher and corporate consultant. So I forecast babies for companies that make things for babies, right? So that keeps me plugged into kind of the current thinking and interests of a lot of America's corporate leaders in the infant and maternity product sector. But then I also do research on broader social, cultural, and political issues related to fertility and childbearing and family formation. And so that's what gets me into some of the broader commentary on this issue, which is what brings me on to places like this to talk about babies and society and the economy and how these things all link together.
And would you say that your focus is purely descriptive, meaning you're doing analysis and presenting data and leaving conclusions and policy recommendations around that data to the readers and to your clientele? Or do you bring to it a prescriptive overlay as well as to what you think we might want the data ideally to be around certain elements of demographics, particularly in family formation, things like that?
Sure. I mean, definitely in the forecasting work I do, it's descriptive, right? There's not really a place for prescription in that. You know, we want to get the data correct. We want to get it right. And we want to make correct inferences about what it means for the future. In policy work, even there, I feel like most of what I do is just descriptive. I feel like a lot of the function I can serve is providing people with better information than a lot of what they're getting in kind of popular media stories on these issues. So my Twitter feed ends up being lots of like graphs and charts and summaries of papers and stuff like that. It's kind of a lot of just trying to do some public education on kind of the sociology of fertility and the economics of fertility. But that said, I mean, I do, of course, have political views on some of these questions, and some of them do touch on policy. And in that, you can get it can become fairly prescriptive.
No, that's fair. And I think that it's a healthy distinction. I can see why your corporate clientele looking for certain data may not necessarily want or need the prescriptive element, but that providing a high level and granular detail in some of the description of trends and whatnot would be valuable. Would you perhaps provide us a couple thoughts around what you see as the major underlying trends right now in American demographics that are most relevant to the economy, to economic growth, to things that somebody may want to be paying attention to that represent maybe a paradigm shift versus past demographic trends? Yeah. What's most on your radar as a sort of professional analyst?
So there are basically three big components to demographic change that demographers like me think about. They are migration, mortality, and fertility. So mortality is a big one. That's deaths, life expectancy. But really in there's more than just life expectancy. It's, you know, public health, the kinds of, you know, the burden of disability, of drug abuse, of violence. Certainly there's a very concerning trend in the U.S. of rising death rates of prime age people. So people who are dying well before their time. And that is driven by, obviously, drugs are a huge part of that, the rapid increase in opioid abuse. But I think sometimes we tend to put blinders on, and we tend to ignore the legal causes of death that are rising and focus on the illegal ones, right? So we talk about gun homicides and drugs, and like, those are the two things that like, oh, these kill Americans at super high rates. And those are really bad things, but they're actually not the only factors. Alcohol deaths in the U.S. are rising faster than gun deaths, and they are now higher than gun deaths. Alcohol deaths are becoming a scourge. They're rising just like drug deaths are.
I'm curious, is that related to automobiles, or is it even separate from alcohol-related?
It's connected to automobiles, but traffic deaths are actually down over the last 15 years. So I was going to say also, you know, Americans die at car accidents at very high rates because we drive a lot and we drive at high speeds. Those are more or less stable over the last 10 years or so, down over the last 20 years or so. So they're not as much of a red flag, but alcohol, suicide, drugs, gun deaths, both from suicide and from homicide and from accidents. All these things are creating increasing burdens of mortality and morbidity. So disability and illness, on Americans. I mean, one of the difficulties with finding workers now in America is a lot of them are injured, disabled, addicted, or otherwise inhibited by these factors. So that's one big trend that I think we're really not dealing with enough.
When did, if you look at those things as sort of a combination, because they belong mm-hmm. in a an isolation, a desperation, an alienation camp, whether it's opioid, alcohol, or suicide, people aren't doing that without some form of desperation yeah. and depression.
So
when did that start picking up?
So there's a tendency to lump these together as deaths of despair. I've intentionally not done so because the best evidence suggests that there's actually different drivers of these different factors, that the things driving suicide are not the same things that are driving homicide, which are not the same things that are driving opioid abuse, which are not, these are actually all quite different. But in general, different factors, including the legalization of extremely powerful drugs, namely easier prescription access to prescription opioids, which this is basically a big experiment in drug legalization. In the late 1990s, and you know, legalized advertising of them and easy prescription of them, this really created a huge addicted population. So states that had stricter laws on prescription of opioids have had much fewer opioid-related deaths. Alcohol changes are a bit different. They're related to underlying cultural shifts. Kind of the teetotaling prohibition generation is fading. And for all that we might have disliked prohibition, you know, drinking less is better for your health. And it's better for the health of people around you because alcohol is a major factor in, of course, car accidents, but also, you know, domestic violence, child abuse. Alcohol is a major factor in these. Not necessarily the cause, but it is a risk factor, right? There's different things driving all these, but you know, mortality is just one of the major demographic threats to U.S. economic growth, these mortality and health risks. But I start with it just to point out that sometimes we have an idea that there's one problem for our growth, and if we fix it, things will be okay. But I start with mortality to say we have a problem there that's been going on for a decade or two. Really, the increases in these things go back about a decade or two, maybe two decades, call it.
So I assume this was the theme pre-COVID, right?
Pre-COVID, yeah. And it got much worse during COVID, yeah.
Yeah. Do you expect demographically that the mortality rate will suddenly drop?
No.
In 2 years, 3 years, 4 years because of pulled forward deaths from COVID?
No, not for these categories. Maybe for old age things, but these are prime age people. Not a lot yeah. of them died from. I mean, some, of course, some people of all ages died of COVID, but death rates among younger yeah. people were much lower. But that's not the only problem factor. There's also migration. In the U.S., we think of ourselves as receiving a lot of immigrants, but in fact, over the last 40 years, migration rates into the U.S. have declined. We're seeing fewer people move to the U.S. Meanwhile, more Americans are moving away from the U.S. In fact, there are now countries in the world where there are more Americans moving to those countries than from them. So, for example, Australia and New Zealand, the U.S. has negative net migration with. This is very strange. This is not what has usually happened in U.S. history. I suspect we might be negative with Canada as well. I live in Canada right now, for what it's worth. A lot of Americans are leaving and fewer people are coming to America. We're becoming a less desirable place to live. A good measure of how desirable a place is and the quality of life is simply its net migration rate. The U.S. is still very positive, but it's becoming less positive over time. And that's a major threat to demographic growth and thus to economic growth.
Can you put some absolute numbers on that as opposed to, I think net migration tricks people up a little. Your point is we still have a very positive rate. There are people leaving, but there are more people coming, but that percentage rate has been steadily declining.
Yes.
On absolute numbers, what are we talking about? How many came in last year and how many left?
off the top of my head.
Or maybe use 2019. So we take 2019 might be better to take COVID out of it.
Yeah. Off the top of my head, I don't have the number. Usually we have about a million who come in legally or illegally. Of course, I'm including illegal immigrants in this. You know, there's no point talking about immigration numbers only of legal, right? But usually we have about a million, though it used to be, we had about a million when we had, 200 million people in our country. Now we have about a million when we have 300 million people. So the rate falls. But meanwhile, the number who leave the country is rising from like 50,000 to 70,000 to 100,000 to 150 to 200. It's steadily rising. That's a problem. And of course, the people who leave America.
Do you have Do you have a feel for what the causation is of most people leaving? Is it tax driven, economic, religious? What are we talking about?
It's not
about?
Tax, because the U.S. will still tax you when you leave.
Yeah.
You can't evade U.S. taxes by moving. I say as someone who is paying U.S. taxes in Canada.
But I was referring to people denouncing citizenship.
Right. But that's a small share of people who leave.
Yeah.
The main reason is that there's more other countries that are good to live in. Global economic growth is creating economic opportunity everywhere. So the relative economic advantage that the U.S. has is just less. Second reason is that the U.S. is really, really expensive. It takes, I'll say this, my wife and I, we started our family in Hong Kong. We've continued having kids in Canada. It's much cheaper to have a family outside of the U.S. than in. The U.S. is just very expensive to be a young person in the U.S. Once you're settled and you have the car paid off and the house paid off and all that, the U.S. is very cheap. Taxes are low. Sales taxes are low. You know, your cost of living can be quite low. But for a young person getting ahead and starting a family, the U.S. is not always a very good place to be. Which is why you see a lot of young people very interested in these international programs, you know, lots of young people looking for English teaching abroad opportunities or for these different, you know, international work opportunities. This is very common for educated young Americans because they often have more opportunities. They can often get a better wage rate for the same degree in a foreign country than in the U.S. Because the U.S. just doesn't provide a good ladder upwards for young people. So they leave. This is a huge problem for the country because many will come back, but many won't. Migration is not as positive a contributor to our growth as it used to be in the past. And then the third one, the one people really know me for, is fertility, babies.
Yeah.
America in 2007, the average family, based on birth rates in 2007, the average woman could expect to have about 2.06 kids on average, which is virtually identical to what we call replacement rate, meaning if we had no migration, the population would be stable in the long run. So we'd be a flat population. Now,
can I ask you a question about that replacement rate? I first got introduced to the concept in Mark Stein's first book, I think, which was heavily about demographics and this notion of demography. At the time, he was comparing the Islamic world's demography to the U.S., but the 2.1 idea and how America had a relative advantage to Europe and Japan, but a disadvantage to the Middle East. This was sort of the way I was introduced to this concept shortly after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And it 2.1, I just sort of took at face value. I assumed the two parents and two kids makes perfect sense because of math. And then the 0.1 I figured was sort of a, albeit crude and depressing, but a kind of tracking error for infant mortality and other things. But how scientific is that 0.1? Is it just sort of a rounding error?
No. So there's actually a way to calculate it. So the actual true replacement rate by country varies. So in the US, the true replacement rate is something like 2.06 or 2.07. In Europe, it's something like 2.03 or 2.04, because the U.S., as I said, has higher mortality of young people. But in Africa or very poor countries, it can be as high as 3. Stable population might require you to have two and a half or three and a half children, because so many children die before they themselves have children. And the relevant measure here is not infant mortality, it's what share of people will die before they reach reproductive age and would themselves be having children. And it's worth noting that this number is not the average number of children that a family needs to have. A family would need to have more because some people will never get married and form a family, right? So
Right.
if 10 or 20% of your population is never going to have children, which is about what it's going to be in Western countries, then your true how many children does a family need to have to, have a stable population is about 10 or 20% higher. So call it 2.4, 2.5.
So just because of math, the more people who never get married, or the more married couples who never have kids, the more per family kids you need to have just to keep that
That's right.
rate.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like
And
for myself,
the more
and
people.
I spend half my time in New York City, and I have three children, and I joke that I can always tell who is a fellow Christian family. My wife and I are Christians, and we have our kids in Christian school. We go to church. We know who is of faith, because if you see a family of three or four kids in New York City, they're probably of faith.
Yeah,
And there are
they're Jewish,
so
Muslim, or
many
Christian.
married couples with no kids or one kid. Those change the averages.
And then also mortality, right? So if more people are dying young, you have to have more children for a stable population. And again, that's a problem in the US. And I would also say there's you can also calculate, there's a very nice paper from just recently where they calculated what are called migration adjusted replacement rates. Basically, okay, so that replacement rate assumes no migration. Well, what if we look at the actual migration rates the countries have? How many children would they have to have for stability given their current migration rates? So how many children would the average American woman have to have to maintain a stable population given the fact that the US does receive positive net migration? The answer is something like 1.75 kids on average. So we get the equivalent of about 0.25 children per woman of migration, right? Okay, so that's migration, or that's fertility. The problem is current US fertility rates are about 1.6. So it's below that 2.06 level, okay? But it's also even below that migration adjusted 1.75 level. So the US is on course for population decline. That's the simple reality is it's entirely likely at this point that I will live to see peak America, which is not actually something that I want to experience, but it's possible. So
So
the obvious,
before we talk about the implications of population adjustment and peak America and these other things that your writing is just so incredibly compelling on, do you mind if I ask you about causation? Myself, as a finance guy, living through the financial crisis, having written a book about the subject, I sort of view the financial crisis as the center of the world of key events economically
It is
in the
important.
last 20 years. And I can't help but notice, although I don't want to be guilty of a correlation causation fallacy, but you refer to what's round up to 2.1 in 2007, and we're at 1.6 now, and something pretty big happened right after 2007.
Yeah,
Is
something
this
did.
correlation or causation?
It's both. When you think about why people do or don't have children, right? You've got two major factors. One factor you can call wanting children, so ideas, values, attitudes. I'm going to call it fertility preferences, which is kind of this technical term for like how much you want to have kids and how many kids you want to have and your family orientation, all that. And then your other factor is the material resources that you have to provide for those children, right? Now, you can call that the cost of children, but it's worth remembering that when we talk about the cost of children, ultimately, two consenting adults can just create a child, essentially for free. However, raising that child, and also raising that child, in principle, has no costs, right? If you want to have a Stone Age cost of raising a child, you can choose to go live a Stone Age life, right? You could go live in a cave. Now, you'll likely have Stone Age mortality. It won't go well for you. So when we talk about the cost of raising a child, we're talking about the socially constructed cost. We're talking about the cost of raising a child to meet the acceptable social norm of how you should raise a child. So the cost of raising a child can go up even if the price tags on the things that children need go down, right? If the price of everything you need for a child goes down, but the childbearing norm changes that now you have to buy your 7-year-old an iPhone, well, the cost of raising a child may have just gone up. Because what we mean is the cost, the socially normative cost of raising a child, the cost of raising a child like a normal person in your society. Now, there are always those of us who will be weirdos. There are those of us like my family who will say, you know what, we're happy to raise our children at a different cost and standard and so have more children. Okay. So, you know, I'm, you know, more power to my homeschool families here. They're choosing a different set of norms that's changing the cost of childbearing. So, you know, great respect there. So the point is that there's these two factors, fertility preferences and then the costs. And the costs are both a socially normative cost and then also how much money you have to throw at it. The financial crisis radically impacted the cost side of things. It really, really shocked the cost side. It set people's life course back a lot. And when you think about the resources people have to raise a family, it's not their income. Income is an irrelevant resource for raising a family. What is relevant for raising a family is social capital and capital. That is, do you have people in your life who will help you? That means a partner, a family nearby or friends nearby or a church or a social community or friends with kids or whatever. And do you have your sort of your balance sheet situation arranged in such a way that you believe your long run financial situation is prosperous enough to support a family? Getting a good bonus 1 year doesn't make people have a kid. Getting their student loans paid off.
But why would recurring cash flow, not a outlier like a bonus, yeah. But why would recurring cash flow not drive
because there's no such thing as,
what yeah. someone's expectation yeah. around the recurrence yeah. of cash flow?
There's no why such would thing that as, not Yeah, so that's you're conflating two things. The expectation of current cash flow and current cash flow are different. Okay. No one looks at their current cash flow and rationally assumes it will continue. Particularly my generation who came of age during the Great Recession. There's a very nice paper showing that the economic volatility that you experience impacts fertility. That is, even if you experience strong economic growth during your life, if it's very volatile, you tend to have lower fertility because it's the volatility that impacts fertility because it makes you believe you need to carry larger reserves, basically. So essentially, high economic volatility increases the kind of reserve requirement that potential parents apply to themselves to have children. And that reserve requirement essentially is their net worth. That the best proxy for having the resources to have children is not your current income. It's your current net worth. So if you have a lot of debt and few assets, you're very likely to say, I'm not in a financial position to have children right now. But if you don't have a lot of assets, you're likely to say that. And this is important because when a recession happens, some people will actually start to have more kids, particularly people who already have a lot of assets and are suddenly already out of work. They'll say, okay, now it's time to have kids. So if a recession
is this a new phenomena? Because yeah. it would seem to me that the boomer generation, I think back to my parents, mm-hmm. They had four children. They were starting in their young 20s. Mm-hmm. My father was a academic and intellectual, never had a balance sheet ever, even up to when he died, and had just month-to-month type income that a teacher and pastor and professor. But I don't know anyone sheet. In his generation that thought about a balance sheet.
No, I'm using that as a technical term. They didn't actually sit down and have that. But they have a sense, because what happened with the boomer generation? Well, their parents bought homes as the greatest generation at a cheap rate. They basically had no student debt, or very little student debt compared to income potential. They acquired housing at a very young age. They actually had a lot of job transitions. In fact, they had less stable employment than millennials have on average, but they were much earlier to acquire social capital and financial capital. That is, to acquire real estate, savings, marriage, these kinds of things that actually enable the long-term commitment of child rearing. Because the thing you have to remember with child rearing, the cost of having a kid is the child rearing. It's those, 10, 20, 30, 40 years where you're involved in raising children. And so you want to make sure that you've got the buffer for that. And so that means you want to have that house. So one of the most effective forms of birth control is being a renter rather than a homeowner. Statistically speaking, renters don't have nearly as many children, controlling for age, socioeconomic status, all this stuff. Because home ownership gives you kind of that buffer. It kind of gives that, okay, so I'm set, I'm stable, I can do these things.
Now, I guess the question,
I should say, the question this goes about back, that. Hold on, I just want to, just to get to, has this, is this recent? This goes all the way back to before modernity. You go back to the 17th century, the 18th century. Women began having children fairly young. Men did not. Men tended to not begin to have children until they were kind of, bought into the farm somehow. They were old enough to be taking serious responsibility for the family farm, or they had their own farm. There was this idea. This has deep roots in human societies going back, at least to like the Neolithic period, that humans want to be able to have a kind of stable state before assuming child rearing costs and responsibilities.
So I guess the two things I know, I'm not sure how to fit it all together in the framework you're providing me, which is just fascinating. I know that there were less homeowners and more renters 50 years ago. And I know that there were more kids per household 50 years ago. How do we square that?
Right. So it's an age cohort effect, right? So homeownership rates among young people are lower now than 50 years ago. It just used to be that there were a lot of old renters in the past. So when you look at the effect of homeownership, you can't look at the homeownership rate. You have to look at basically the homeownership rate among young adults. So like in their 20s, really. That's kind of your most relevant indicator is what share of people are becoming homeowners in their 20s or reaching positive net worth in their 20s or something like that. So
the great financial crisis impacted balance sheet. And I guess that's probably the interesting part is maybe
it impacted assets even more than income, right? So this was the big thing is fertility kept falling long after employment was recovering from the Great Recession. People are like, why? We're no longer in recession. Income is rising. Well, we now know from the Survey of Consumer Finance, income rose, net worth didn't for young people. For young people, net worth didn't rise. They did not have a recovery in their assets. And so fertility didn't rise.
But how come, though, post-crisis, 401ks have exploded, housing prices reflated.
Yeah, old people.
Why wouldn't that have helped the demography by now?
Because
it
was old people.
The fertility side of demography.
Because it was old people. 50-year-olds don't have a lot of kids. The relevant thing so what for you're net saying, worth
but
of
what
young
you're
people,
saying is, but why wouldn't 401ks have gone up for 20-year-old, for 28-year-olds, for 33-year-olds too?
Well, they also had an employment interruption, right? And yeah. because those things compound with time, the earlier you get them, the more valuable they are. So the reality is having an interruption early in your career has compounding effects for your entire life, right? They're never going to accumulate the same assets. And so it's a permanent effect. And so financial crises do have permanent fertility effects. And I should note that the United Kingdom, it's complicated. There's a very nice paper doing this, but basically a random subset of British households got a huge cut to their monthly housing payment during the Great Recession because of the interest rate policies of the Bank of England. Because of just some unique quirks in the British mortgage system, okay? Those families had a huge increase in their fertility because their monthly housing payment crashed, right? Essentially what happened is, now that's a positive shock to their income, but practically speaking, being able to have the interest on your loan suddenly crash that reduces your monthly payment is also, practically speaking, an increase in your expected future net worth, right? Because if suddenly your loan has lower interest, then your expected future payments fall.
Fascinating. So do you think that there is, beyond the kind of impact to compounding of capital and the decision-making that came out of that period, the enhanced economic mm-hmm. volatility, which clearly has a impact on child-rearing decisions, do you think that part of it is cultural, mm-hmm. where out of the financial crisis, yeah. people just sort of saw lower economic growth, which we know has been half of the post-war trend? We mm-hmm. averaged 3.1 real GDP growth for 70 years. We're now in 14 years of half of that.
Yeah.
Do you think that those things are the chicken or the egg? Because that's where I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah.
I certainly believe we're in a negative feedback loop, yeah. but did one cause the other, or is one the effect of the other?
So I was trained as an economist. But I'm now a sociologist. So the answer is, economists like to do on the one hand, on the other hand. So I guess as a sociologist, I get a third hand where I can say everything is culture. Sure. So there is a cultural component, but it's not quite what people think. So we have regular surveys, very high quality surveys. I run some of them myself, where we ask people, do you want to get married? When do you want to get married? How important is marriage to you? Do you want to have kids? How many kids do you want to have? How important are kids to you? Answers to these kinds of questions have not changed in the last 20 years. They just haven't. People still want to get married. They want to get married about when they have wanted to, at about the same stage in life. They still think it's super important. People want to have kids. They want to have about as many kids. It's as important to them as it's ever been. There's not been a change in these core family desires. Now, there have been changes in plenty of social and cultural arenas. Any one of them could matter. You hear about rising climate change worries, or, is something about do LGBTQ individuals have different fertility, or all these things. And I've explored different elements of this. Most of my research has found that most of these factors don't have a very large impact on overall fertility. It's possible that lots of tiny factors altogether are impacting fertility. But none of them seem to be like a silver bullet explanation. The one possible exception is declining religiosity. Declining religiosity is strongly associated with lower fertility. The U.S. has had a pretty sharp decline in religiosity in the last 20 years, 30 years. But the reality is that these cultural factors are difficult to believe, at least in terms of ideas, because these fertility declines we've seen are happening in lots of different countries all at once, which suggests we should really look for a common factor. And a major housing and financial crisis is a nice common factor. Now, what it could have done is that It's quite possible that this economic shock catalyzed existing underlying changes, right? That there were already ideologies that kind of nudged people towards low fertility, but good economic times were buffering that. But then bad economic times causes like a reset that you shift down to a different set of validating ideologies, right? Whatever the economic circumstance, people will look for an ideology that comforts them in their circumstances. And so if you wanted to have a family, but now it's economically unobtainable, it might not be comfortable to continue to adopt an ideology that says you should have a family. So maybe instead you start to say that you're child free instead of childless, right? Beyond that, I think that we are seeing most low fertility can be explained by things like delayed marriage, delayed entrance into various milestones of adulthood. People who get married at a given age still have about the same number of children as 20 years ago. Marital fertility, so to speak, has not changed radically. This is mostly about interruptions in the life course, milestones, and wealth accumulation of young people, that we've created a more delayed life course. But that could feed into
I think I heard you wrong then. You're saying marital fertility is not lower, and yet we've created a delayed life course.
Yeah.
How could someone who's not getting married till 38 have the same amount of kids that people used to have at 24? Right.
So one is that they used to have two, and you can still have two at 38. Average fertility.
But they used to have three.
No, average fertility has been two for about two or three generations.
So, but what I'm saying is, a family, someone who would get married at 25, they would often have three or four, and other people were having less. Yeah.
And somebody who gets married at 25 today is still likely to have about that many.
I see.
It's just that fewer people are getting married at that age.
And then so that's brought the overall fertility rate down.
Right. Okay. And then there's fewer people getting married overall. So that's the key thing to understand is, like, are there cultural changes? Yes, there's always cultural changes. Could they matter? Yeah, they could. And there's also things that are like at the connection of culture and economics, right? So where do you place something like social media? Is that a cultural change or an economic change? Well, it's both, right? And it could be that social media has changed how people interact with social capital and community life and relationships in a way that has altered their propensity to have children. You can imagine that being the case. There's not great research on that, but I think it's usually, I like to kiss, keep it simple, stupid. Once you control for marital status, there has not been very much change in fertility over the last 20 years. There's been some, but like not a lot. And the change in marital status is pretty much due to, once you control for like age at first job, age at completion of education, age at home ownership, all these things, like the age at marriage thing goes away. It's basically delayed economic entrance leads to delayed relationship formation, stable relationship formation, which leads to delayed fertility, which leads to less fertility.
And so, first of all, I think listeners of this podcast know that I'm probably sitting here chomping at the bit because I categorically reject the idea that economics and sociology are entirely separate, because, you know, your two disciplines, I think, harmonize in a lot of ways, because, and I assumed you probably would, because I view economics as the study of human action, and I believe human beings were made to be in community with one another. There is both an individual and a social dimension to mankind that strikes me as integral to the very discipline of economics. So therefore, I think these things are much more connected and overlapped.
No, I agree, but it tends to be some disciplinary rivalry between the two. So I've spent my time in both departments. So
I hear you. Well, I suspect that subject, that is fascinating, that the where you adjust for marital trends, the fertility is not necessarily as on decline. It's more that there's just simply less people getting married, or getting married much later. That I don't know how we could separate that from religiosity, because I just don't see that trend in faith circles. I just don't see it.
Yeah. So, I mean, it is definitely related to religiosity, but it's related in a complicated way. Getting married and having children also makes people more religious. So when people get married, they tend to become more religious. When they have children, they tend to become more religious. So separating these is really complicated. It's not a simple task.
Yeah. And do you have data, going back to that point I made about Mark Stein's point many years ago, do you see this in Middle Eastern countries differently? Are they slowing down? In other words, my kind of prima facie assumption has been the radical secularization of Japan and rapidly humanistic trend in Europe, that's been the lead to declining fertility. And now America's catching up with that. And yet other both religious and cultural trends in the Middle East are different, which is why their fertility has stayed high. Has that started to change as well?
It depends on the country. So what you're talking about is sometimes referred to as a fertility stall. So like Egypt and Saudi Arabia are like the classic examples of places where fertility fell and then it kind of stopped. Turkey had a bit of one, but now, I mean, places like Turkey and Iran, their fertility is falling very rapidly. Saudi Arabia doesn't always have reliable data, so it's hard to tell, but I mean, we see fertility falling in most of these countries. Not always every year, not always as fast as in other places, but yeah, fertility decline is quite general. So much so that now, I mean, there's a nice contrast in Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan is Shiite, Armenia is Armenian Apostolic, Georgia is Georgian Orthodox. And then you have Turkey to the west of them, which is Sunni. Of those four, who would you guess has the highest fertility? The Sunni, the Shia, the Armenians, or the Orthodox? Well, the answer? It's the Orthodox.
Really?
Yeah, and there's a variety of idiosyncratic reasons for that, but they now have the highest fertility. And then the Shiites, and then the Sunni, and then the Armenians. It's a complicated world out there. And yeah, Muslim fertility is falling as well. Yeah, it's not always as low or as fast, but yes, it is. In general, it is tending to fall.
And so when you look at these areas, we look at mortality, migration, and fertility as sort of the three major categories within your discipline and expertise of demography. When we go back to your original training as an economist, is your general concluding direction around these trends, how they impact future productivity, how they impact future economic growth? Are you in the population plus productivity equals growth camp? How do you want us to think about the economic implications of these trends that you are spending your life studying?
Yeah, so you got to ask, why do people innovate? Productivity is basically, in the long run, or it's not synonymous with, but in the long run, it's going to be driven by innovations, various kinds. So why do people innovate? They innovate because they need to. There's two reasons people might need to innovate. One is because there's a problem that needs to be solved. There's a new disease spreading. We need a vaccine. So we're going to make a new vaccine. We're going to innovate. The other is because they need a job. So you don't have a job. So what are you going to do? You're going to start a food truck. Or you're going to start selling something. You're going to make something and sell it. Okay. So these are basically kind of your two big kinds of innovation. Is there's a social problem that needs to be solved, and so companies try to solve it. And the other is basically you need a job, and so you're going to solve the problem of not having a job by starting a company, starting a business, starting a product, something like that. Both of these turn out to be population relevant. The number of people who need a job and can't find one rises as population rises, and there's actually some very nice empirical work showing that faster population growth does lead to higher rate of entrepreneurship and a higher rate of entrepreneurship, to higher business dynamism, all that stuff. So point one right there, faster population growth means more entrepreneurship, more economic dynamism. Second factor here is those big problems. So let's say you have a big problem, like you want to switch away from fossil fuels to a new energy source. Well, that's a big capital cost. In fact, most innovation is capital intensive, right? Because you have to spend the money on research up front for an uncertain future return. Okay. So the bigger the potential market for that future return, the more lucrative the investment becomes. So if you have a choice between replacing the power grids of a place with a declining population and a growing population, which one do you replace? The growing population, because it's going to be easier to amortize the costs in the long run, right? Because it's growing, demand's growing. You know you're going to sell the electricity you produce. As population declines, solving your problems often becomes harder because you actually benefit from from basically scale diseconomies. That is, you're going to be selling to fewer and fewer consumers in the future, right? This is a huge problem. It's why it's really hard to replace the power grid in West Virginia, but somewhere like Arizona can just dump out new power all the time from whatever kind of renewable energy they want, right? West Virginia is not that big. Why is it so hard to replace the power grid? Why? Because there's no economic case for it. There's not going to be as much demand in the future. So it's why it's hard to clean up the power plants in China or in Eastern Europe. Population's declining. The economic case for replacement is not strong. Just extend the life a few more years. Maybe you won't need it in the future. You can apply this to all kinds of things. Innovation requires scale. You need a big market to sell to. You need a growing market so that there's always new consumers who don't already have loyalties. Consumers who are already loyal are hard to poach. You need new consumers who don't have loyalties yet. My point is, a growing market feeds innovation. A shrinking market kills it. Nobody looks at the declining population regions of the Rust Belt and says, that's an innovation hotbed. It's not what happens. Declining population means declining demand for housing, which will ultimately lead to housing being a net negative investment. You won't make money on your house, right? Well, guess what? Most small businesses use home equity as their starting capital. So what happens when you can't do that anymore? Well, you don't get as many small businesses. So I wrote a whole paper on all these kinds of linkages. The point is, in the long run, low population growth will have negative effects on productivity because it'll have negative effects on innovation, entrepreneurship, business startup, and economic dynamism generally.
And so do you see
One last dark thing here. We actually do know what a zero population growth society looks like because this was humanity for most of its history. Most of our history has been basically zero population growth. And most of our history has been dominated by what? Entrepreneurship? Economic dynamism? No. It was dominated by a feudal aristocracy that inherited all their wealth. And guess what happens? When most people have only one child, you know what happens to the wealth of two parents going to one child? It concentrates more and more at every generation. So low fertility and zero population growth, we already know what this looks like. This is a society of extraordinary inequality, massive perpetuation of wealth across generations, and the reinstitution of hierarchies and classes that we have blessedly largely escaped in high-income societies.
So was the explosion of population growth the cause or the effect of the Enlightenment, the Industrial Revolution? Where do you put that kind of hockey stick start at?
Yeah.
And is what you're predicting that if we don't solve for population growth, that we could go back to much more muted economic growth rates had throughout most of history?
It's causing and consequence. They go together. The ultimate cause of economic growth is basically innovation. It's ideas that spread and took root, and that's going to go down to institutional factors related to the fragmentation of states in the Holy Roman Empire, and the Dutch Republic and all these fun things. But that's boring to get into. The point is that they're causing a consequence. And if we consent to be a shrinking species, we are not long going to find that we are a species shrinking, but with growing liberty and expansive ambition. We will find that we are shrinking in number, liberty, and scope of our dreams.
So what I like about a lot of the ways you're diagnosing this is you hear people from time to time join us in expressing a fear about population issues, but they focus it around the demand side of the economy, that there will be less customers in the future of goods and services, and that'll put downward pressure on economic growth. But you seem to have a really supply side orientation to the damage that it brings down the supply of innovation. Mm-hmm. Declining population growth puts downward pressure on dynamism, on the need to solve problems. Am I hearing you correctly?
Yeah, that I mean,
there
put it
this is way. Much more at stake here than just less customers.
Put it this way. Let's assume that incredible innovators like Albert Einstein or something are randomly distributed. That anytime a baby is born, they have a 1 in a million chance of being a super innovator. Okay. That means every child that's born adds to society's chance of getting a super innovator. It only takes one Albert Einstein to give the world all the things he learned. You know, it only takes one to give the world E equals MC squared. It's that simple. Innovation is it benefits from scale. The more people you get, the more chances you have of drawing a super innovator, right? And the more super innovators you draw, the richer everyone is.
It's fascinating.
So, I mean, yeah, look, there's demand side too. Like, people get into this, like, oh, you know, the market size growth and who are we going to sell our hot dogs and iPhones to? And okay, it's interesting stuff. I get it. But ultimately, the roots of prosperity is not just a numbers game. It's an ideas question. It's are you innovating and creating ideas?
And do you join the fray of those who think demographics are a big problem for housing, and that we need constantly increasing housing prices, and we won't get that if we don't have more people needing houses, and we won't need more people needing houses if we don't solve for population growth? Or do you think that's a somewhat misunderstood conclusion of the current demographics debate? I see it as a supply-demand issue where we're not building enough houses, and that it's cyclical, and that we have gotten too focused on permanently unaffordable levels of housing being an allegedly good thing, which is hurting household formation.
So, I mean, we're not building enough housing. We need to be building way more housing at all levels of the market so that people can afford it. In general, building more housing, it does discipline price growth, but having neighborhoods become denser does not reduce the value of the houses there. It tends to increase it. When you see places with very, now that said, there's a catch-22 here, right? You build houses, it reduces housing price growth. But I've just said that one of the problems with low population growth is low housing price growth. Okay, so how do you square that? And the answer is there's a difference between supply and demand, right? If housing prices are falling because housing supply is huge, that's a good thing. Because housing yields real benefits to the people who buy it. It's not just a financial asset, right? It also yields their imputed rent, essentially. So the thing about housing is it's a financial asset, but it's also a real good. And the real good yields real consumer welfare, real benefits that you can often measure in various ways. Being unhoused has measurable problems. Switching from renting to owning has measurable changes. So what we want to do is we want to flood supply so that lots of people can get those real benefits. And in getting those real benefits, We have maximized sort of the real welfare in society, which should drive economic growth. And as economic growth goes, and as people have houses, that will lead to lots of customers, which will create demand for houses. So this is one case where Say's law may not usually be true, but in housing, there is a lot of truth to it, that across generations, if you build it, they will be born.
Well, and I happen to think Say's law is right a lot more than that, but you're certainly right in this case that there's a sort of pro-cyclical benefit around this, and that that supply does indeed create that demand. Look, there are so many implications to this work you're doing in the economic dimension. You know, we kind of got to cover at a high level the mortality and migration side, and have now delved into this fertility issue. But really, each one of these could warrant its own podcast. And I know you've done so much writing. I'm going to put the article that you referenced, the paper you've written, into the show notes. But I just can't thank you enough for coming on the podcast and approaching some of these subjects. I think that in a world obsessed right now with monetary policy and obsessed with GDP growth, from the kind of vantage point of what its political ramifications may be, it sure seems to me that the generational economic story is going to be in these fields of demographics. And so your work around fertility, migration, mortality is deeply appreciated, not just by myself, but those of us at National Review and listeners of Capitol Record. And I would love it if you'd be willing to come back on the podcast again.
Happy to. Just let me know when.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it. Well, I hope you got a lot out of that. Migration, mortality, fertility, three kind of different angles of this overall subject of demographics and what it means to economic growth, economic expectations, economic calculation. There are so many different kind of avenues you could turn on and go down to better unpack. And I really appreciated his wide range of topics that I think are all relevant to us. A lot of history, a lot of sociological data to consider, but just chew on all of it, think it over, send in questions, and we're going to continue kind of seeking to apply all this in the best way. And we're going to do that towards the aim that is our aim, which is the cause of a free and virtuous society. Thank you, as always, for listening to Capitol Record. Please subscribe to your feed of choice. Please send this out to friends. Rate and review us, and good things will happen in your life. Don't rate and review us, and I think you will feel punishment coming your way. Thanks for listening to the Capitol Record.